welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. We've spent the last several weeks on thrillers and mysteries, but today we're headed off in a different direction. This week's show will preview titles that focus on families and the crazy quilt way they're put together in 2015. The heroes and heroines we'll meet today must bravely rebuild and redirect the path of their lives after being pushed off course. I'm thrilled to welcome JoJo Moyes back to the program. She's just out with a sequel to her incredibly popular Me Before You, a book that spent 65 weeks on the Times bestseller list and is now being made into a movie. Today, JoJo stops by to give us a first glimpse into her new title, After You. I'm sure you're as eager as I am to get started, so let's turn now to page one of the book report. A new title by Jonathan Franzen is a big event in the publishing world. His newest, Purity, has young Pip Tyler at its center. Pip doesn't know who she is. She knows her real name is Purity, that she's saddled with $130,000 of debt, that she's squatting with anarchists in Oakland, and that her relationship with her mother, her only family, is hazardous. She doesn't have a clue who her father was or why her mother has chosen to live as a recluse. A brief encounter with a German peace activist leads Pip to an internship in South America with the Sunlight Project, an organization that traffics in the secrets of the world. TSP is the brainchild of Andreas Wolf, a charismatic provocateur who rose to fame in the chaos following the fall of the Berlin Wall. Now, on the lam in Bolivia, Andreas is drawn to Pip for reasons she doesn't understand. Her intense response to him upends her conventional ideas of right and wrong. An ensemble cast performs the book.
Her colleagues' cubicles were covered with photos and clippings, but Pip herself understood the attraction of invisibility. Also, she expected to be fired any month now, so why settle in? "Have you given any thought to how you want to not celebrate your not birthday?" she asked her mother. "Frankly, I'd like to stay in bed all day with the covers over my head. I don't need a not birthday to remind me I'm getting older. My eyelid is doing a very good job of that already. Why don't I make you a cake and I'll come down and we can eat it? You sound sort of more depressed than usual."
"I'm not depressed when I see you."
"Ha. Too bad I'm not available in pill form. Could you handle a cake made with stevia?" "I don't know. Stevia does something funny to the chemistry of my mouth. There's no fooling a taste bud, in my experience."
"Sugar has an aftertaste, too," Pip said, although she knew that argument was futile.
"Sugar has a sour aftertaste that the taste bud has no problem with because it's built to report sourness without dwelling on it. The taste bud doesn't have to spend 5 hours registering strangeness. Strangeness, which was what happened to me the one time I drank a stevia drink. But I'm saying the sourness does linger. There's something very wrong when a taste bud is still reporting strangeness 5 hours after you've had a sweetened drink. Do you know that if you smoke crystal meth even once, your entire brain chemistry is altered for the rest of your life? That's what stevia tastes like to me.
I'm not sitting here puffing on a meth stem, if that's what you're trying to say."
"I'm saying I don't need a cake."
"No, I'll find a different kind of cake. I'm sorry I suggested a kind that's poison to you."
"I didn't say it was poison. It's simply that stevia does something funny
to your mouth chemistry, yeah."
"Pussycat, I'll eat whatever kind of cake you bring me. Refined sugar won't kill me. I didn't mean to upset you. Sweetheart, please."
No phone call was complete before each had made the other wretched. The problem, as Pip saw it, the essence of the handicap she lived with, the presumable cause of her inability to be effective at anything, was that she loved her mother, pitied her, suffered with her, warmed to the sound of her voice, felt an unsettling kind of non-sexual attraction to her body, was solicitous even of her mouth chemistry, wished her greater happiness, hated upsetting her, found her dear. This was the massive block of granite at the center of her life, the source of all the anger and sarcasm that she directed not only at her mother, but, more and more self-defeatingly of late, at less appropriate objects. When Pip got angry, it wasn't really at her mother, but at the granite block. She'd been 8 or 9 when it occurred to her to ask why her birthday was the only one celebrated in their little cabin, in the redwoods outside Felton. Her mother had replied that she didn't have a birthday. The only one that mattered to her was Pip's. But Pip had pestered her until she agreed to celebrate the summer solstice with a cake that they would call Not Birthday. This had then raised the question of her mother's age, which she'd refused to divulge, saying only, with a smile suitable to the posing of a cone, "I'm old enough to be your mother."
"No, but how old are you really?"
"Look at my hands," her mother had said. "If you practice, you can learn to tell a woman's age by her hands." And so, for the first time, it seemed, Pip had looked at her mother's hands. The skin on the back of them wasn't pink and opaque like her own skin. It was as if the bones and veins were working their way to the surface, as if the skin were water receding to expose shapes at the bottom of a harbor. Although her hair was thick and very long, there were dry-looking strands of gray in it, and the skin at the base of her throat was like a peach a day past ripe. That night, Pip lay awake in bed and worried that her mother might die soon. It was her first premonition of the granite block. She'd since come fervently to wish that her mother had a man in her life, or really just one other person of any description, to love her.
We've just heard Purity by Jonathan Franzen. Jojo Moyes is a Londoner. After a diverse career, including stints as a minicab controller and a typer of Braille statements for the blind, Jojo attended a postgraduate course in newspaper journalism. She then worked as a journalist for 10 years in England and a year at the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong. Jojo has been a full-time novelist since 2002, when her first book, Sheltering Rain, was published. Since then, she's written 11 other novels, one of which, Me Before You, was nominated for Book of the Year at the UK Galaxy Book Awards. Jojo lives and writes on a farm in Essex, England, with her journalist husband and their 3 children. Today we'll speak with Jojo about her new title, After You. Welcome, Jojo. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
You never know what will happen when you fall from a great height. While there are many ways to interpret that statement, tell us how it relates to your main character, Louisa Clark.
Well, when we meet Louisa, it's 18 months after a kind of catastrophic, life-changing event that readers of Me Before You will be familiar with, and I kind of don't want to say too much just in case some of your listeners haven't. And it's really about how you rebuild a life that has gone kind of slightly off the rails and hopefully addresses the issue of grief, but not too depressingly. You know, I do believe that it's as important to put laughs in your book as well as tragedy. So that's what I've tried to do.
You know, I really want to congratulate you. This sounds odd to say, but you have such a light touch with a very, very serious topic.
Oh, thank you. It's a really fine balance, and I'm never quite sure if I get it right. So when someone like you says that, it really means a lot. I just feel that, you know, in my own life, some of the darkest moments have involved kind of bursts of possibly inappropriate laughter, you know, and it's like that thing where the people with the best jokes are always the people who work in the emergency services, you know, the people who really have to rub up against the grubby business of life and death tend to be the best at kind of making laughs as well. So, yeah, it's a tricky balance, but, I think it's one that readers enjoy.
I wanted to ask you, can a reader pick up After You without first having read Me Before You?
I would very very much hope so, but if I'm honest, I think that you will get more from it if you have read the first one. It's like, you know, I'm a great fan, for example, of Game of Thrones, and I think you could read any one of those books, but I think you'll get more from it if you start from the beginning.
I love the book's concept of becoming a donut instead of a bun. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. I was trying to describe the process of moving on after losing someone you love. And, you know, I, like most people, have lost people that I've cared deeply about. And the thing that really struck me was how you don't lose that person. They never completely leave you, and you don't get over their loss. But what you do is you adapt around it. And I have one of the characters describe it as becoming a donut instead of a bun, you know, like a ring donut. You just adapt around the hole. And I guess I like to describe kind of concepts in ways that people will just be able to relate to their own lives. And the donut thing just sprung to mind. And I'm glad that stuck with you, because I was worried that people would think it was too frivolous, but I liked it.
The main character of the book is Louisa. And I think we have to talk about Will Traynor a bit. Will you tell us a little about him?
Okay, so Me Before You is about Will Traynor, who's a man who has everything. You know, he's one of these masters of the universe. He leads a huge life. He's rich. He's handsome. He has a beautiful girlfriend. His favorite thing is to kind of hurl himself at life. He does adventure holidays and jumps out of planes and scuba dives. And then all this comes to a halt in one split second when he gets hit by a motorbike in a random accident. And he's left quadriplegic. And Me Before You is the story of what happens when he decides after 2 years of living as a quadriplegic that he doesn't want to live life anymore if it can't be on his terms. And it's what happens when a small-town girl, Louisa Clark, enters his life and discovers what he plans to do, and she decides she's going to change his mind.
Introduce us to Lily.
Okay, so Lily is the character that really starts changing Lou's life again. And I don't want to give too much away about her, but she's a teenage girl. She's 16, 17 years old. She crashes into Lou's life one night, and through a series of events, Lou has to kind of take charge of her. And she thinks it's going to work a certain way, and of course, like real life, it rarely does. But the two people, Lou and Lily, have things to teach each other, and they end up looking out for each other, and she becomes a really central part of Lou's recovery, and Lou helps her a lot too, you know. And I was really interested to write about teenage girls, because I look at the pressures they face and the landscape that they're having to navigate, and it's so different from what we had to do when we were teenagers.
We're speaking with Jojo Moyes on the Book Report. You know, I loved Ambulant Sam, and I loved that their relationship, Lou and Sam, was evolving so slowly. Tell us a little about him.
Well, I wanted Lou to have a love interest in this book, but at the same time, I realized that Will was really a hard act to follow, because so many women have messaged me or emailed me to tell me how much they love him. And so I knew that Sam could not be anything like Will, because otherwise he would just end up as kind of a pale imitation. And he went through several metamorphoses, but the thing that I felt about him being a paramedic was that he is one of the few people who can really understand something of what Lou's been through. And also, I just wanted him to be really sexy. You know, she had kind of a perfect pure love in the previous book, but I kind of felt that, you know, she's in her late 20s. She needs to kind of grow up and really kind of move on in all sorts of ways. And it was just nice to see Louisa discovering the physical side of herself as well.
You know, you wrote about becoming someone's center, and that idea really resonated with me. How did you get that kind of clarity of thought and convey it so beautifully?
Well, it's kind of, you'd say so. Sometimes these things I think out really clearly before I come. You know, like I often have a theme as well as a plot. So, you know, I ask myself the question, I have it pinned above my computer screen, what is this book really about? Almost as a flash, when I suddenly worked out that one of the things that she would be carrying, as well as the guilt, is kind of an anger that in some ways she hadn't been enough to him to save him, to save Will. And what she realizes quite late on with Sam is that she can be everything to someone, that she can be something so important that, you know, without giving too much away about the plot, that she can kind of bring him back. And I just thought it was a lovely image. You know, that's all we really want from anybody, isn't it? To be their center.
Absolutely. Yes. Maybe For You is being turned into a film. How are you involved in the production?
Well, I wrote the script. I wrote the first draft and about a billion drafts in between, and then the final shooting script. And I was involved on set every day while we were shooting it. So I feel like I couldn't really have been any more involved than I was. And I think it was quite an unusual experience, because I know a lot of Hollywood studios don't really want the original writer anywhere near, and often, you know, for good reason. But I think they felt that this book had a particular voice, and also because it just has such a passionate readership, I think they wanted to make sure that they were as close to the original as they could. You know, I mean, you always have to make some compromises because it's a different medium and the time constraints and all the rest of it, but I really hope that readers will feel that we got as close to it as we could.
When can we expect to see that movie?
I think it's out in the first half of next year. It's still in the edit suite at the moment, but it's all looking good. So fingers crossed, it won't be too long.
Will Louisa and Sam return in another novel?
I might think they will. I would love to write a third book. I don't think I would write more than three, but I certainly have seen it as a trilogy, and I have a rough idea of something that I would like to happen. But I really want to think it through and make sure that it's the best plot that I can come up with. And so it won't be the next book I write, but it might be the one after.
And are you already at work on your next novel?
I'm not actually. Writing the Me Before You script gave me a bit of an appetite for screenwriting. So I've actually adapted two of my own books for the screen. One Plus One, which is with New Line, part of Warner Brothers at the moment. And then I'm just working on another one. So that's pretty much me and touring for this book until the end of the year. And then I'll start writing a new book at the beginning of next year.
Well, JoJo, I'm looking forward to the movie and absolutely your next novel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Right. Bye now.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sample of After You, performed by Anna Acton.
It is then that I notice the big man's coat is still over his bar stool. I walk over and glance up at the monitor. The flight to Munich would be just boarding. If I felt inclined to run his coat down to him, I look again, then walk slowly to the gents. Hello? Is anyone in here? The voice that emerges is strangled and bears a faint edge of hysteria. I push the door. The Scotch drinker is bent low over the sink, splashing his face. His skin is chalk white. Are they calling my flight? It's only just gone up. You've probably got a few minutes. I make to leave, but something stops me. The man is staring at me, his eyes two tight little buttons of anxiety. I can't do it. He grabs a paper towel and pats at his face. I can't get on the plane. I wait. I'm meant to be travelling over to meet my new boss, and I can't. I haven't had the guts to tell him I'm scared of flying. He shakes his head. Not scared. Terrified. I let the door close behind me. What's your new job? He blinks. Car parts. I'm the new senior regional manager, bracket, spares, close bracket, for Hunt Motors. Sounds like a big job, I say. You have brackets. I've been working for it a long time. He swallows hard. Which is why I don't want to die in a ball of flame. I really don't want to die in an airborne ball of flame. I'm tempted to point out that it wouldn't actually be an airborne ball of flame. More a rapidly descending one, but suspect it wouldn't really help. He splashes his face again and I hand him another paper towel. Thank you. He lets out a shaky breath and straightens, attempting to pull himself together. I bet you never saw a grown man behave like an idiot before, huh? About four times a day. His tiny eyes widen. About four times a day, I have to fish someone out of the men's loos, and it's usually down to a fear of flying. He blinks at me. But, you know, like I say to everyone else, no planes have ever gone down from this airport. His neck shoots back in his collar. Really? Not one. Not even a little crash on the runway. I shrug. It's actually pretty boring here. People fly off, go to where they're going, and come back again a few days later. I lean against the door to prop it open. These lavatories never smell any better by the evening. And anyway, personally, I think there are worse things that can happen to you. Well, I suppose that's true. He considers this and looks sideways at me. 4 a day, huh? Sometimes more. Now, if you wouldn't mind, I really have to get back. It's not good for me to be seen coming out of the men's loos too often. He smiles, and for a minute I can see how he might be in other circumstances. A naturally ebullient man. A cheerful man. A man at the top of his game, of continentally manufactured car parts. You know, I think I can hear them calling your flight. Do you reckon I'll be okay? You'll be okay. It's a very safe airline, and it's just a couple of hours out of your life. Look, the SK-491 landed 5 minutes ago. As you walk to your departure gate, you'll see the air stewards and stewardesses coming through on their way home, and you'll see them all chatting and laughing. For them, getting on these flights is pretty much like getting on a bus. Some of them do it 2, 3, 4 times a day, and they're not stupid. If it wasn't safe, they wouldn't get on, would they? Like getting on a bus, he repeats. Probably a lot safer. Well, that's for sure. He raises his eyebrows. Lots of idiots on the road. I nod. He straightens his tie. And it is a big job. Oh, shame to miss out on it for such a small thing. You'll be fine once you get used to being up there again. Maybe I will. Thank you. Louisa, I say. Thank you, Louisa. You're a very kind girl. He looks at me speculatively. I don't suppose you'd like to go for a drink sometime. I think I hear them calling your flight, sir, I say, and open the door to allow him to pass through. He nods to cover his embarrassment and makes a fuss of patting his pockets. Right, yeah, sure. Well, off I go then. Enjoy those brackets. It's 2 minutes after he has left that I discover he's been sick, all over Cubicle 3.
That was After You by Jojo Moyes. Meet Uva. He's a curmudgeon. He has staunch principles, strict routines, and a short fuse. People call him the bitter neighbor from hell. But behind the cranky exterior, there's a story and a sadness. One November morning, a chatty young couple with 2 chatty young daughters move in next door. They accidentally flatten Uva's mailbox. Thus begins a series of events that lead into a comical and heartwarming tale of unkempt cats, unexpected friendship, and the ancient art of backing up a U-Haul. George Newbern narrates.
Uva checked his watch and took a left turn down a smaller, quiet road. This entailed a longer route to the shopping center, but there were fewer traffic lights. Not that Uva was mean, but as anyone who knows anything knows, cars use less fuel if they keep moving rather than stopping all the time. And, as Uva's wife often says, if there's one thing you could write in Uva's obituary, it's at least he was economical with gas. As Uva approached the shopping center from his little side road, he could just make out that there were only 2 parking spaces left. What all these people were doing at the shopping center on a normal weekday was beyond his comprehension. Obviously, people no longer had jobs to go to. Uva's wife usually starts sighing as soon as they even get close to a parking lot like this. Uva wants to park close to the entrance. As if there's a competition about who can find the best parking spot, she always says as he completes circuit after circuit and swears at all the imbeciles getting in his way in their foreign cars. Sometimes they end up doing 6 or 7 loops before they find a good spot, and if Uva, in the end, has to concede defeat and content himself with a slot 20 yards farther away, he's in a bad mood for the rest of the day. His wife has never understood it. Then again, she never was very good at grasping questions of principle. Uva figured he would go around slowly a couple of times just to check the lay of the land, but then suddenly caught sight of the Mercedes thundering along the main road towards the shopping center. So this was where he'd been heading, that suit with the plastic cables in his ears. Uwe didn't hesitate for a second. He put his foot down and barged his way out of the intersection into the road. The Mercedes slammed on its brakes, firmly pressing down on the horn and following close behind. The race was on. The signs at the parking lot entrance led the traffic to the right, but when they got there, the Mercedes must also have seen the two empty slots because he tried to slip past Uwe on the left. Uwe only just managed to maneuver himself in front of him to block his path. The two men started hunting each other across the tarmac. In his rearview mirror, Uwe saw a little Toyota turn off the road behind them, follow the road signs, and enter the parking area in a wide loop from the right. Uwe's eyes followed it while he hurtled forward in the opposite direction with the Mercedes on his tail. Of course, he could have taken one of the free slots, the one closest to the entrance, and then had the kindness of letting the Mercedes take the other. But what sort of victory would that have been? Instead, Uwe made an emergency stop in front of the first slot and stayed where he was. The Mercedes started wildly sounding its horn. Uwe didn't flinch. The little Toyota approached from the far right. The Mercedes also caught sight of it and, too late, understood Uwe's devilish plan. Its horn wailed furiously as it tried to push past the Saab, but it never stood a chance. Uwe had already waved the Toyota into one of the free slots. Only once it was safely in did Uwe nonchalantly swing into the other space. The side window of the Mercedes was so covered in saliva when it drove past that Uwe couldn't even see the driver. He stepped out of the Saab triumphantly, like a gladiator who had just slain his opponent. Then he looked at the Toyota. "Oh, damn," he mumbled, irritated. The car door was thrown open. "Hi there," the lanky one sang merrily as he untangled himself from the driver's seat. "Hello, hello," said his wife from the other side of the Toyota, lifting out their 3-year-old. Uwe watched repentantly as the Mercedes disappeared in the distance. "Thanks for the parking space, bloody marvelous," the lanky one was beaming. Uwe didn't reply.
"What's your name?"
the 3-year-old burst out. "Uwe," said Uwe.
"My name's Nazanin," she said with delight.
Uwe nodded at her. "And I'm Pat," the lanky one started saying. But Uwe had already turned around and left.
"Thanks for the space,"
the pregnant foreign woman called after him.
That was a sampling of A Man Called Uwe by Frederick Bachman. Every story has two sides. Every relationship has two perspectives. And sometimes, the key to a great marriage is not its truths, but its secrets. In Fates and Furies, Lauren Groff tells the tale of one such marriage over the course of 24 years. At age 22, Lotto and Mathilde are tall, glamorous, and madly in love. They are destined for greatness. A decade later, their marriage is still the envy of their friends, but complicated. With compelling revelations and multiple threads, Will Dameron and Julia Whelan perform a novel about love, art, and creativity.
Lotto loved the story. He'd been born, he'd always say, in the calm eye of a hurricane. From the first, a wicked sense of timing. His mother was beautiful then, and his father was still alive. Summer, late 60s, Hamlin, Florida. The plantation house so new there were tags on the furniture. The shutters hadn't been screwed down and made a terrific din in the wild first passage of the storm. Now, briefly, sun. Rain dripped off the sour orange trees. In the pause, the bottling plant roared 5 acres across his family's scrubland. In the hallway, 2 housemaids, the cook, a landscaper, and the plant's foreman pressed their ears to the wooden door. Inside the room, Antoinette was aswim in white sheets, and enormous Gawain held his wife's hot head. Lotto's Aunt Sally crouched to catch the baby. Lotto made his entrance, goblinesque with long limbs, huge hands and feet, lungs exceeding strong. Gawain held him to the light in the window. The wind was rising again, live oaks conducting the storm with mossy arms. Gawain wept. He'd hit his apex. "Gawain Jr.," he said. But Antoinette had done all the work, after all, and already the heat she'd felt for her husband was half diverted into her son. "No," she said. She thought of a date with Gawain, the maroon velvet in the theater, and Camelot on screen. "Lancelot," she said. Her men would be knight-themed. She was not without humor of her own. Before the storm hit again, the doctor arrived to sew Antoinette back together. Sally swabbed the baby's skin with olive oil. She felt as if she were holding her own beating heart in her hands. "Lancelot," she whispered. "What a name. You'll be beat up for sure. But don't you fret. I'll make sure you're Lotto." And because she could move behind wallpaper like the mouse she resembled, Lotto is what they called him. The baby was exigent. Antoinette's body was blasted, breasts chewed up. Nursing was not a success. But as soon as Lotto began to smile and she saw he was her tiny image with her dimples and charm, she forgave him. A relief to find her own beauty there. Her husband's family were not a lovely people, descendants of every kind of Floridian from original to Mukwa through Spanish and Scot and escaped slave and Seminole and carpetbagger. Mostly they bore the look of overcooked cracker. Sally was sharp-faced, bony. Gawain was hairy and huge and silent. It was a joke in Hamelin that he was only half-human, the spawn of a bear that had waylaid his mother on her way to the outhouse. Antoinette had historically gone for the smooth and pomaded, the suave steppers, the loudly moneyed. But a year married, she found herself still so stirred by her husband that when he came in at night, she followed him full-clothed into the shower, as if in a trance. Antoinette had been raised in a salt box on the New Hampshire coast. 5 younger sisters, a draft so dreadful in the winter that she thought she'd die before she got her clothes on in the morning. Drawers of saved buttons and dead batteries. Baked potatoes, 6 meals in a row. She'd had a full ride to Smith, but couldn't get off the train. A magazine on the seat beside hers had opened to Florida. Trees dripping golden fruit, sun, lux, heat. Women in fishtails undulating in mottled green. It was ordained. She went to the end of the line, the end of her cash, hitched to Weeki-Wachee. When she entered the manager's office, he took in her waist-length red-gold hair, her switchback curves, murmured, "Yes."
We've just heard Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff. Never judge a book by its cover. But how about judging one by its title? The title of Lauren Holmes' new story collection is one I could not resist, Barbara the Slut and Other People. In Desert Hearts, a woman takes a job selling sex toys in San Francisco rather than embark on the law career she pursued only for the sake of her father. In Pearl and the Swiss Guy Fall in Love, a woman realizes she much prefers the company of her pit bull to the neurotic foreigner who just won't decamp her apartment. In How Am I Supposed to Talk to You, a daughter hauls a suitcase of lingerie to Mexico for her flighty, estranged mother to resell there, then wondering whether her personal mission to come out is worth the same effort. And in Barbara the Slut, a young woman with an autistic brother, a Princeton acceptance letter, and a love of sex navigates her high school's toxic, slut-shaming culture with open eyes. You'll be charmed by Georgina Marie's narration.
She gave me a million kisses all over my face and my hands. She touched my hair, which had always been long but now was short. She started to cry. "Hi, Mama," I said. "Hi, baby," she said. "I knew that was your bus. You're so beautiful." She took my free hand and I wheeled my suitcase into the courtyard. There was a pool in the middle with strings of lights around it, and the doors to the rooms were around the courtyard in an L shape. The office was separate from the L, between the pool and the street. She opened the door and we went inside. It was cool in there, and I wondered if she was the only person in Pie de la Cuesta with air conditioning. Her apartment was above the office, and we walked up the stairs. It looked like no one lived there. There were no plants or pictures or glasses of water, just a couch and a wooden chair in the living room, and a square table and two more chairs in the kitchen. In the bedroom, she put my suitcase down. There was a bed with no frame and another chair. But the bed had her same white sheets on it, these sheets that cost $1 million and feel like clouds and smell like clouds. My mom got into the bed and I got in with her. She traced the spot on my forehead where she said I had a swirl of hair as a baby. Every muscle in my body relaxed. She stroked my head and then I was 10 years old, and we were lying in the cloud sheets in Los Angeles, and I was crying because we had to put our dog Maria von Trapp to sleep. That night my mom had stroked my head until I fell asleep. I don't know where my dad was. He was there when we put Maria to sleep, but then not there later. After a while, my mom said, "Are you hungry, baby?" And it brought me back to the present and being 20, and I felt embarrassed to be in bed with my mom. I wanted to sit up, but I was too weak. I tried to open my eyes, and my mom laughed at me. "I'm starving," I said. She went to the kitchen and made me an egg sandwich, which is one of my favorite things, with Oaxacan cheese, which is another one of my favorite things. She cut up a papaya and two bananas, and she ate the fruit while I ate the sandwich. After breakfast, I asked my mom if I could make a phone call. "Of course, baby. Who do you want to call?" "I want to tell Dad I got in safe." "Oh," she said. She said that the phone in the office didn't make long-distance calls, but she gave me a phone card and told me there was a payphone to the left of the hotel. When I got to the phone, I dialed Dana's number. I had told her I would call her every day, but now that I was here, I didn't really feel like it. "Hey, it's me," I said when she picked up. "Hi," she said. "I was so worried about you." "Why?" I said. "I told you I would call you when I got here." "I know, but I was worried. How's your mom?" "She's fine. How are you?" "I'm really great. I haven't eaten or used an animal product in 42 days. "Oh, right," I said. "That's good. Did you come out to your mom yet?" "No, I've only been here for like an hour." "I can't wait for you to tell her. I'm so proud of you." I told her I would call her the next day, and then I hung up by accident. Then I called my dad and made the mistake of telling him about the buses. "You got in the middle of the night," he said, "and your mother couldn't pick you up?" "It's safer to take the buses at night," I said. "This is not what we agreed," he said. "I'm going to call her." "Dad, please don't call her. I'm fine. I want to have a good time." He said he would wait until I was back to call her, and I said okay, and hoped he would forget by then. He told me to call Dana because she had called the house twice. He made me promise to wear sunscreen and to not go swimming. He said he was reading about Pie de la Cuesta on the internet and the undertow was deadly.
That was Barbara the Slut and Other People by Lauren Holmes. Fans of The Lost Generation, of Scott and Zelda, Hemingway and Picasso, will be fascinated with Liza Klausman's Villa America, a new take on Gerald and Sarah Murphy, the fabled Americans who made the French Riviera the place to be in the 1920s. When Sarah and Gerald met and married, they set forth to create a beautiful world together, one they couldn't find within the confines of New York City society. They packed up their children and moved to the south of France. On the coast of Antibes, they built Villa America, where a group of bohemian artists and writers became deeply entwined in each other's affairs. There, the Murphys regaled their guests with flamboyant beach parties, fiery debates over new ideas, and dinners beneath the stars.
When a tragic accident brought Owen, a young American aviator, to the south of France, he found himself drawn into the flamboyant circle. The Murphys soon found their world unexpectedly and irrevocably transformed. Jennifer Woodward performs the book.
Gerald thought about Pitts all the way home from school. He thought about him from the moment the bell rang at the Blessed Sacrament Academy, during the long walk through Central Park, nurse's hand clamped painfully on his wrist, all the way to his house on West 57th Street, so that by the time they reached his brownstone, his excitement was so great that he felt he might pee in his pants a little at the thought that the dog would be waiting for him behind the heavy black door. Pitts had been his special birthday present when he turned 10, almost a year ago now. Mother had been sick with baby, whatever that meant, and Gerald had been given Pitts, to teach him responsibility, his father had said. Gerald had heard the words, but they'd barely registered, because at the same moment the wiry-haired fox terrier had bounded through the door into the drawing room. Today his friend was exactly 1 year old, and Gerald had smuggled him 2 butter biscuits from his lunch. He'd been very careful not to let the biscuits crumble in the pocket of his wool coat, or to let Nurse find them. Nurse hated Pitts. She said he was dirty, and that he would bite them all one day, and might even smother baby in its sleep. Gerald knew this was a lie. Pitts was special. He had been his special present, and now he was his special friend. Pitts was all around special. Best of all, the dog could read his mind. He saw him doing it. Pitts would cock his head when Gerald was thinking something secret, and Gerald knew that Pitts knew what he was thinking. Now, as the black door was opened at last, Pitts was waiting, and Gerald almost cried with relief. He didn't know why, but he feared that one day the door would open and Pitts wouldn't be there.
"If you want to play with that filthy beast, it will be out in the garden," Nurse said.
Gerald looked at Pitts, gingerly feeling the biscuits in his pocket. It was January and the wind bit into his nose, but he'd rather be freezing outside with Pitts than warm indoors with Nurse. He made towards the back door.
"Gerald Clary Murphy."
Nurse could make her voice tower. That was the only word Gerald could think of for it, the way it seemed to grow bigger and bigger until it was looming over him.
"What do we do first?"
Gerald reluctantly turned and headed for the stairs to change out of his uniform. Pitts just looked at him. He knew better than to try to follow Gerald upstairs when Nurse was around. The house was chilly and the curtains were drawn against what was left of the day. His father said only invalids lived in warm houses. Murphys, he said, didn't get sick, although Mother had been sick with baby. Gerald had seen baby, and baby looked fine to him. Mother was very white, though, and would call out often for Nurse in a high voice, saying baby was unwell or that baby was strange. On the second floor, Gerald had to be very quiet when he passed Mother's door or the nursery so that Mother wouldn't get upset. Nurse was marching behind him, and he hoped she wouldn't try to take his coat with the biscuits, because then he would be punished and Pitts would be banished to the cellar again. Pitts was supposed to sleep in his basket in the little room off the kitchen, but it was so very cold there, it even seemed cold in summer. At night, if it was quiet, Gerald would sneak downstairs after his prayers and spirit the dog back to his own bed on the third floor. Sometimes Nurse checked, and on those occasions, if she found Pitts, his friend would be locked in the cellar. Sometimes Nurse wouldn't let Pitts out until the following afternoon, and Gerald would see his friend's eyes, haunted after a day down in the dark with no food or water. When this happened, Gerald knew it was his fault, and he wouldn't try to smuggle Pitts upstairs for a while. But inevitably, after a week or so, he would chance it again.
"Give me your coat," Nurse said, holding out her strong hand to Gerald. "You can wear the play coat outside in the muck."
That was a sampling of Villa America by Liza Klausman. opens, Glamour magazine's book editor, Elizabeth Egan, brings us Alice Pierce, a compulsively honest, longing-to-have-it-all sandwich generation heroine for our social media-obsessed age. Alice is a mostly happily married mother of three, an attentive daughter, an ambivalent dog owner, a part-time editor, and a loyal neighbor. She is not a cook, a craftswoman, a decorator, an active PTA member. But when her husband makes a radical career change, Alice lands a job at Scroll, a hip young startup that promises to be the future of reading. The holy grail of working moms, an intellectually satisfying job, and a happy personal life seem suddenly within reach. Despite the disapproval of her best friend who owns the local bookstore, Alice is proud of her new balancing act. Until her dad gets sick, her marriage flounders, her babysitter gets fed up, her kids start to grow up, and her work takes an unexpected turn. Julia Whelan narrates.
In my book, January and February are just frozen appetizers for the fillet of the year, which arrives in March, when you can finally wear a down vest to walk the dog. That's when I commit to my annual resolutions, become more flexible in all senses of the word, stop snapping at my family, start feeding the parking meter, take wet laundry out of the machine before it mildews, call my mom more, gossip less. Throughout my 30s, the list has remained the same. On this particular sunny and tentatively warm day, I was driving home from spin class, daydreaming about a pair of patent leather boots I'd seen in the window of a store near my office. They were mid-height and semi-stylish, presentable enough for work, with a sole suited for sprinting through the aisles of Whole Foods. Maybe I recognized a little bit of myself in those boots. After all, I fit the same description. When I stopped for a red light in front of the high school, my phone lit up with a photo of Nicholas. The snapshot was 3 years old, taken on wooden bleachers at the Y while we were waiting for our son, Oliver, to finish basketball practice. Splayed across Nicholas's chest was the paperback edition of The Cut by George Pelicanos. While he grinned at my then-new iPhone, our daughters, Margot and Georgie, each leaned in and kissed one of his cheeks. "Hey, what's up? I'm just driving back from Ellie's class. Since when does Stairway to Heaven qualify as a spin song?" Silence on the other end. I noticed a spray of white crocuses on the side of the road, rearing their brave little heads. "Nicholas, are you there?"
"Yeah, I'm here."
Another pause. "Nicholas, are you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine. I just..."
More silence. I watched as a group of high school kids trampled the crocuses with their high tops and Doc Martens. The light turned green. "You just what?"
"Listen, Al, I'd rather not have this conversation on speaker while you're driving. Can you call me when you get home?"
I felt a slow blossom of anxiety in my throat. When someone starts talking about the conversation in the third person, you know it's not going to be pretty. "Nicholas, what's going on?"
"I can't... You know what?"
I heard a noise in the background that sounded like a big stack of papers hitting the floor.
"Actually, I'm coming home. I'll be on the 11:27 train. See you soon."
There was a strain in his voice, as if someone had him by the neck. "Wait, don't hang up!" But he was gone. Suddenly, I felt chilly in my sweaty clothes. I distractedly piloted my minivan down Park Street, past a church, a temple, a funeral home, and a gracious, turreted Victorian we'd lost in a bidding war when we first started looking for houses in Filament. My mind raced with possibilities. Nicholas's parents, my parents, his health, an affair, a relocation. Was there any chance this urgent conversation could contain good news, a windfall? What was so important that Nicholas had to come home to say it to me in person? In the 7 years we'd lived in New Jersey, he'd rarely arrived home before dark, even in the summer, and most of our daytime conversations took place through an intermediary, his secretary, Gladys, doyen of the Stuyvesant Town bingo scene. I called Nicholas back as soon as I pulled into the driveway of our blue colonial. When the ringing gave way to voicemail, I suddenly felt dizzy, picturing the old photo pressed to my ear. The girls had grown and changed since then, Margot's round face chiseling down into a preteen perma scowl, Georgie's toddler legs losing their drumstick succulence. But what struck me was Nicholas's jet black hair. It had been significantly thicker in those days, and a lot less gray. I couldn't remember the last time I'd seen him kick back with a book, let alone look so relaxed. I was about to find out why.
We've just heard A Window Opens by Elizabeth Egan. Readers, unlikely love stories and complicated family dynamics are tough to navigate, but make for some fabulous reading. For more stories that will resonate with you and leave you thinking about them long after the last page, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.